Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello, everybody. Here's a question you may not be expecting to hear. Are some kind of peace talks possible in the Syrian civil war? The word today is that Secretary of State John Kerry is working with Russia on a peace conference between the Assad government and the rebel leaders. We'll get a take on this now from Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation, who has been calling for a non-military solution, even if Syria used chemical weapons. We'll also get Katrina's reaction to the Benghazi hearings yesterday that seemed to be intensifying an atmosphere of political scandal around the deadly attack there last September 11th. Hi, Katrina. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
First, where have you been, by way of background, on this issue of a U.S. response to Syria after these revelations about chemical weapons?
Well, as you know, Brian, we don't know if the Assad government or the rebels have used chemical weapons. And I think that the president's sensible caution in accepting any conclusive evidence of reported use of chemical weapons is important. I think the larger issue, if I could, is that it seems to me this is a heartbreaking, heartrending humanitarian situation. There are no good choices, no good military options. And I think that what we're witnessing today, as we learn of the Russian-U.S. talks at the end of June, is the possibility that we may see, not a breakthrough yet, but at least at the beginning, moving toward a political resolution, which I think is critical. We've learned, Brian, is the costs, the terrible costs of U.S. intervention in Iraq, Afghanistan, should show us that we must be cautious. And given the complexities of the sectarian conflict, the civil war raging in Syria, I believe it is right to avoid any rush into another war in the Middle East and any opportunity for diplomacy. Re-engaging Russia is key, and that is what we're witnessing.
I know you're suspicious of U.S. military intervention around the world and think it often comes to bad. But at some point when a moral monster like Assad is murdering tens of thousands after tens of thousands with chemical or conventional weapons, and we know it's happening with conventional weapons, doesn't the civilized world, the international community, not the U.S., but maybe centrally involving the U.S., need to go in and stop it by force if necessary?
You know, I think that what we're witnessing here is the importance of the United States working with regional powers and international force to find a way to resolve the humanitarian disaster. I mean, if you look, and it's not the case that the nation or I have opposed any use of military force, but if you look at what we've seen again in Iraq or what we've seen in Afghanistan, and the intervention that will necessarily involve nation building in the midst of trying to disarm competing militias, and the possibility that arming rebels with heavier weapons will offer no humanitarian solace for civilians. It seems to me what we need to accept is what you said, that Syria is a humanitarian nightmare, which the United States and the international community should do more to address. Washington should help create and sustain more havens in Jordan and elsewhere for refugees. The millions of refugees who've been displaced should coordinate with other countries to get aid in faster, more effectively. John Kerry, in addition to having been in Moscow and negotiating a diplomatic push to end the civil war in Syria with his counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, is also announcing today in Rome a 25% increase in American humanitarian aid to Syrian civilians. And I think we need to double down on humanitarian assistance
and
intensified diplomacy, which, if I might, one of the great diplomats of our time is currently the UN Arab League envoy to Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, whose diplomacy has been stalled for months by divisions in the UN Security Council, which is very real. He says this is the first hopeful news today, this news of a U.S.-Russian conference concerning this country, which he just is spoken of in heart-rending, heart-wrenching terms that he's seen in a very long time.
And the reports say that Kerry and Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, would like to see these talks begin within a month from now between Syrian government and rebel leaders. But, you know, my first reaction is extreme skepticism that Assad would seriously consider submitting to that. Do you think he would?
I think Russia has enormous influence with its ally, and I think what we're looking at is the importance of tough, smart diplomacy. It appears that the proposal Kerry negotiated with the Russians accepts the premise that Assad's government would at least have a say in negotiations. But if they begin, just as Russia accepted that Assad would most likely not be in power if an agreement is reached on a transitional government. So I think, you know, we need to engage, again, the regional powers. We need to engage Russia very seriously. I think we've made a grave error in the last few years, failing to understand that Russia is an important partner in this part of the world. And, you know, let's also step back for a moment, Brian. You know, the American people don't share this kind of, if I could use the word carefully, lust for war that we hear on our Sunday talk shows too often from those who, if they feel so strongly about military intervention, might put their bodies on their line, Lindsey Graham, Bill Kristol. I mean, Americans show wisdom in their fatigue of wasting lives and resources on misadventure abroad. Most Americans oppose even sending arms and supplies to the rebels in Syria. We're also looking at the fact we don't know, we don't have the wisdom to understand, in a country already awash with heavy weapons, who's where, what. And a lot of these rebels, as has been reported, perhaps more carefully than the chemical weapons reports, have ties to Al-Qaeda. The horrors cannot be ignored, the humanitarian horrors, but nor can the fact that if the United States continues without any legal basis to wage war in countries which don't pose a terrorist or national security threat to the United States, nor a threat to international security, we will see more and more resentment of this country, more and more insecurity, and not much help or solace for the very civilians we should care about in important ways.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation. Before we go on to Benghazi as another topic, what do you make of Russia agreeing to such talks with Kerry? According to the New York Times, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov did indicate that an outcome should be or could be a transitional government that does not include Assad. So what's in it for them after resisting Western-led regime change and being so supportive of Assad, as you know, as you rightly said a minute ago, they have been over these last 2 years of civil war? What changed in Russia?
I think that they understand the end game is near. They understand the importance of a politically negotiated resolution. They understand the instability in the region can backfire against them. And you know, they also, as we've seen in these stories out of Boston, Tsarnaev's visit to Dagestan, they face in their own borders Islamic radicalization in terms of the conflicts, the roiling conflicts in the Northern Caucasus. So I think they see the importance of working with the United States and reengaging that partnership. And I have to say, I think Secretary John Kerry, as you probably know, Brian, you know, he has spent quite a bit of time studying the crisis in Syria. This was a year or so before he became Secretary of State. He has had good relations with Lavrov, who is the supreme diplomat, and I think they understand the importance in their national interest. And in the end, one has to tap the national interest if you're going to have a diplomacy that can work for people. Now, let's be clear. This isn't a breakthrough. It's a beginning. But I think both countries have realized that a negotiated transition of power in Syria is better than a fight to the death, which would destabilize the region.
All right. Well, on another subject, the previous Secretary of State is in the news again. Did you watch the Benghazi hearings yesterday? The number two U.S. diplomat in Libya, who became number one after Ambassador Chris Stevens was killed, says he was demoted for questioning the Obama administration's handling of and inaccurate description of the Benghazi incident. How much of a scandal do you think this is for President Obama or Hillary Clinton?
I think it's more partisan politics. I think little new information was provided at the House Benghazi hearing. You never want to hear of retaliation against whistleblowers or, you know, he was a riveting storyteller. But, I mean, this was...
And even Democrats acknowledged that he was a whistleblower, called him that.
Yeah, and I think we've seen... I mean, listen, the Obama administration in different areas has cracked down on whistleblowers in dangerous ways, in my mind. But did we learn anything? I mean, it seemed that it was more, as I said, kind of partisan politics, Republicans clearly politicizing the deaths of these diplomats. And, you know, when you step back, the essence of the Benghazi story is not Watergate, which Lindsey Graham wants to make it out to be. It's some very serious questions, which I do think the State Department report, which Ambassador Pickering led, addressed. Why, for example, have we seen cuts in security funding at embassies? That is something over $300 million over the strong objections of Senator Clinton and President Obama. I mean, there was a little bit of a feel of Republicans planning for the 2016 presidential campaign, trying to use this against Hillary Clinton. And I'm not sure why, after several hearings, many hearings, this had to be the top priority yesterday in the House. But to go back to a larger point, to step back and not make it partisan, it seems to me that what we're looking at is that the violent actions against U.S. embassies one in Benghazi, are taking place in countries where the U.S. helped the opposition and longstanding dictatorships and authoritarian governments in the Arab Spring. But in many ways, the U.S. support for the Arab Spring is greatly overshadowed by years of support for those regimes and by the association of the U.S. with the dictators in the regime. Right. And it's interesting that the hearing that really was important was about a week or so ago on drones, where we heard from someone from Yemen who spoke of the hatred and resentments the drone programs are spawning in those countries. And I think
and
we need to look at that.
That's an issue that we spend a lot of time on as well, I think, in the media in general. But on yesterday, I mean, Libya was a country where the U.S. did not happen to support the dictator. And I want to play you two clips from the hearing. And obviously, there is politics in play here. But on the content, one question Republicans are raising is, who ordered a special forces team not to come in and add to the rescue mission that was underway? Here is a 45-second exchange yesterday between Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz and Greg Hicks, this number two diplomat in Libya, about the events of that night. Congressman Chaffetz first.
But were any of these U.S. military personnel not permitted to travel on a rescue mission or relief mission to Benghazi?
They were not authorized to travel.
What happened with those personnel?
They remained in Tripoli with us. The medic went with the nurse to the hospital to lend his skills to the treatment of and care of our wounded.
How did the personnel react to being told to stand down?
They were furious. I can only say, well, I will quote Lieutenant Colonel Gibson. He said, "This is the first time in my career that a diplomat has more balls than somebody in the military."
So Greg Hicks with Congressman Chaffetz. So I guess they're asking.
I'm all for diplomats having more cojones than those in the military.
Would it have been the commander-in-chief in a situation like that to make that decision?
Well, I mean, didn't during questioning, Hicks also confirm that the team was ready to be deployed, not to join the fighting at the CIA annex, but to secure the airport for the withdrawal of our personnel from Benghazi? And he also confirmed it was the second such team to be ready for deployment, with the first having proceeded to Benghazi earlier. I mean, if the Republicans are interested in more information from these witnesses, then there should be a reopening or a new investigation and amplification of the State Department's Accountability Review Board, which the Republicans don't think is legit. But I feel that some of the core issues, again, the U.S. role in the world, or, for example, something that emerged very movingly after the death of the ambassador, is that many ambassadors are worried around the world that they end up living in bunkers because of what happened in Benghazi. And part of what being an American ambassador or diplomat is in the world is to be able to engage with the population, to speak to the best values of America. So there's something that's, if there is stuff to be pulled out, it should be. But I'm not sure, again, that it was more than partisan politics. There was little new information.
One other clip, though, when you talk about if there's something to be learned, reopen the investigation. One of the charges is basically that there may have been a cover-up ordered by the administration. One congressman asked about his Hicks's conversation with a State Department lawyer when Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz was coming to Libya to investigate the Benghazi incident, and listen to that exchange.
Tell me about those conversations, what those lawyers instructed you to do on Mr. Chaffetz's visit to Libya.
I was instructed not to allow the RSO, the acting deputy chief of mission, and myself to be personally interviewed by Congressman Chaffetz.
So the people at state told you don't talk to the guy who's coming to investigate?
Yes, sir.
Said don't talk with the congressman? Now, you've had several congressional delegations come to various places you've been around the world. Has that ever happened where lawyers get on the phone to you prior to a congressional delegation coming to investigate a time when we've had four Americans lose their lives? Have you ever had anyone tell you don't talk with the people from Congress coming to find out what took place?
Never.
So, Katrina, does that smell of cover-up? What if the Bush administration had done that on a WMD's investigation or something?
You know, I think always be skeptical of government power or abuse. Hicks, in this case, did have damning things to say about the State Department trying to block him from cooperating with Darrell Issa's committee. But that wasn't quite the evidence Issa had promised, that politics drove the administration's response to Benghazi. I think we heard, in a way, less a whistleblower, more a storyteller yesterday, or hearing a story of confusion and desperation on the ground. And, again, some of what Hicks spoke of in terms of a military response has been refuted by those he says have less balls than diplomats, the military. But I have deep skepticism and concern when you hear about trying to cover up information. Let us hear more. But I'm not sure that Darrell Issa's very partisan, hyper-partisan committee is the venue, because it's become a loop in the conservative information or kind of their alternative universe, as opposed to something that could, in fact, improve the condition of our embassy's security. And I think that is what we should care about and find a way to depoliticize it, which was not the case in yesterday's hearing.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the sequester versus Head Start. We'll talk to Yvette Sanchez-Fuentes, the director of the Head Start program. Can kids in these pre-K programs muster as much political power as the airline travelers did a few weeks ago to stave off these cuts and 70,000 being eliminated from Head Start programs? We'll try to find out.